All right, well, good morning. Really great to see so many people dedicated to Configuration Manager here in the audience. How many are using ConfigMan 2012 R2 today? Great. Almost everybody in the room. That's wonderful. How many people are actively using Config Manager to deploy Windows 8? All right, just quite a few. Great. All right, so my name is Greg Ramsey. I'm an enterprise strategist. I work for Dell. I'm in Dell IT. I'm one of the guys that manages the Configuration Manager infrastructure and a lot of the other System Center tools.
I'm Bill Moore. I'm a client engineer in Dell IT. My team is a global team responsible for operating system deployment and application delivery.
Just a brief overview today. We're going to talk a bit about planning for OS deployment. We're also going to share a little bit of our Windows experience and talk about how we've enabled our users and improved their experience in the Windows 8 and 8.1. And we're also going to talk a little bit about application delivery and OS maintenance once you've deployed that operating system. Very brief, we have a little bit of a background of where we are. We've got about 109,000 workstations, pretty heavily mobile. We are running ConfigMan 2012 R2. We are also in many of the early adopter programs for Microsoft. So we spend a lot of time on the bleeding edge, staying up with configuration managers so that we can deploy the latest operating systems as we go. I also wanted to point out that we use self-service for applications for our users quite heavily. We've been doing it ever since Run Advertised Programs back in the SMS 2003 timeframe. So it's really important in our environment, once the OS is deployed, users know that they go to Software Center or to our application portals to actually install, for example, Project. If you need to do your job, you go and install the software. All right, so let's talk a little bit about OS deployment and planning, as well as our reference builds.
All right, so Microsoft released in a public beta build 9431 in the June timeframe of 2013. We started our testing at that same time as part of a technical adoption program for Configuration Manager 2012 R2. As part of that process, we had already made a conscious decision to begin moving forward with Windows 8.1 as a corporate standard sometime in 2014. We began having some conversations with our third-party providers for antivirus and drive encryption and kind of laid the groundwork and some expectations for where we wanted to be at the beginning of the new year. In mid-October, Microsoft released its released Windows 8.1 publicly and followed that up in the December 2nd timeframe with the Microsoft Desktop Optimization Pack. For us, that provided at least two of the tenants that were required for security within Dell. We were able to utilize System Center Endpoint Protection to meet our antivirus requirements and then to also to utilize BitLocker for third-party encryption. One of the questions that we received quite a bit as part of the early adopters program and the change of the operating system has been with the transition of Office 2010 to Office 2013, and then, of course, the migration of Windows 7 to Windows 8.1. Our users have noticed that things are very different, and they've been doing a little digging and exploring and have had some questions about 32 versus 64-bit Office on a 64-bit image. Rest assured, Microsoft recommends 32-bit Office to take care of any type of potential incompatibilities with plugins or any third-party add-ins that that you might be utilizing. 64-bit Office is really for those individuals who have high memory requirements around the applications in the Office suite. Excel is the one that really comes to mind.
Just another thing to add for antivirus third-party encryption, by leveraging the Microsoft products, as Bill mentioned, it helped us move forward during our pilot. It also gave us the ability to highly encourage our third-party vendors to get that support sooner than later. Let's talk a little bit about IE Enterprise Mode.
We're going to talk a little bit about, you can't really talk about application compatibility without talking about the browser. We have roughly 2,500 web apps in Dell that are used every day. And so, as you may know, Internet Explorer 8 still holds about 20% of the Internet Explorer market share. Now, rest assured, about 19% of that usage is within Dell. You guys only have to deal with about 1% of it. but it's really driven some new standards, some new processes inside of Dell. And Microsoft has really been working hard on browser compatibility and the next generation browser. And I don't know if many of you noticed in IE 10 that was released with Windows 8, enhanced compatibility mode was a new option in the advanced options there. And this was, enhanced protected mode was a new option available. Now, they made this enhanced protected mode enabled by default in the October release of Windows 8.1. And we realized pretty quickly that enhanced protected mode didn't necessarily work with a lot of the ActiveX controls and just the internal websites that we were running. And so it was immediately obvious to us that we were going to have to disable it. Well, sometime in the December timeframe, Microsoft did that for us in a round of patching. So they're taking this feedback that they're getting from the community and they're slowly making changes to the browser as we move along. Update 1 brought us enterprise mode, i.e., and enterprise mode is another bridge that Microsoft is giving its customers to migrate these legacy applications into the modern browser. And just real quickly, locally or via group policy, you can enable enterprise mode and allow the users to select options that will provide compatibility throughout their browsing experience. As a systems administrator, I have the ability to collect and collate that data and share it with the application teams through an enterprise list manager. I can make entire domains, sites, or subsites available via compatibility view for a targeted group of systems or for my organization as a whole. And so what this does is it allows us to collate, crowdsource that data, hand it back over to the application teams and say, these people are saying that your site is not compatible. What do we need to do to get you off of this compatibility list and up to date on modern browser? So compatibility mode, i.e., is a huge help to identifying those applications where you may or may not have some compatibility issues.
Yeah, I think the crowdsourcing is pretty impressive. I'm looking forward to seeing how that adds value, like you said.
So some group policy considerations. There wasn't a whole lot to go on in the October timeframe, but you can go out to the Microsoft download site and do a simple search on group policy for Windows 8.1, and there's a great spreadsheet that you can download that'll outline all of the new group policy changes in Windows 8.1. I highlight here that some of these changes are very apparent to the user. So they're not these little granular changes. Some of them are. Some of them are a little bit more obvious. OneDrive and Sync is a really good example. In an enterprise our size, we like to keep a whole lot of data under the control of the company for obvious reasons. So we don't want disparate data out in locations that are unmanaged by Dell. And so as we were working through what options we turn on and we turn off, we came across, for instance, OneDrive, which is really probably the best cloud integration that I've ever seen in any product. But you'll see here that once these options are turned off, they're still available to the user, but these little toggles are not movable. And there is some dialogue there that kind of alludes to, well, your administrator can resolve this. I don't know if there's something wrong or not. And we've highlighted here in red that the default options that are set when you link a domain account to a personal user account, these options in red are automatically set. So there's some serious considerations here. Do you want password syncing to happen, right? Do you want your start settings, your start screen layout, you know, to potentially be modified? We're talking about merging the user and the domain client together. Here's a really good example. Do you want Angry Birds on your home system and your work system and leveled up to level 14?
Or do you only want it on your work system?
Yeah.
Right.
So it's definitely a consideration, something you want to look at. Disabling some of these options does not necessarily remove the availability of the user to see them. So test, test, test. If you're going to make any modification to a Windows 8.1 build, customizing the start screen is the one thing that you can do that will make a user immediately productive. Anybody that's logged into Windows 8 or Windows 8.1 for the first time realizes that you're immediately immersed with a lot of tiles. You may or may not know exactly what they do, but it turns you into a hunter pretty quick. Where's Outlook? Where's this? Where's that? So we spent a lot of time really looking at what the start screen layout needed to look like for 100,000 systems, right? And what we came up with was a subset of apps that everybody uses, Outlook, Link. They need to get to their desktop. Everybody needs software delivery. Everybody's cutting out pictures of cats and sending those around, so they need a snipping tool. And what we found was, through this early adopters program, going back and querying these users, that we actually had an environment of people that immediately wanted to show off their start screens, right? So there was some training that was happening too, right? I can pin apps, I can remove apps, I can label app groups, tile groups. We can resize, right? I can modify some accent colors. I can really truly make this my environment to work in. In order for us to do that at an administrative level, we can either do it in such a way that it's really user-friendly, so users got the opportunity to go in and create the environment that they want to work in, or we can drop the hammer, right? We can create a consistent environment. It's going to be the same way across all of our workstations. Two employees go in front of a customer, their environment's going to look exactly the same. We opted for the more user-friendly approach. And one thing I want to point out is that with Windows 8.1 update, no longer do you have the automatic boot to the start screen. So if you have a touch device, you will go to start. If you have a non-touch device, then you're presented with the classic Windows desktop. So we're good there. So we've got some options when it comes to customizing start. All of these options are supported and documented on TechNet. Copy profile and start tiles, both use an unattended XML, would be created with a Windows System Image Manager. Copy profile clearly offers the most opportunity for customization and for the end user to be able to make some modifications to their work environment. Apps folder layout, so really just a simple file copy that's done after a system is sys-prepped. Start tiles, I had a really hard time figuring out why anybody would want to use start tiles, and ironically, I work for an OEM. Start tiles uses an unattended XML basically to set the default location of the 24, possibly 26 now after update, tiles that are the default tiles in Windows. So we probably do it. You can't add anything, take anything away, but you can set the location and the size of the tile. And then obviously group policy. Gosh, if there's a registry setting for something, you can do it with group policy. In our case, we went with apps folder layout. And why we did not go with copy profile came down to one simple reason. We're using a configuration manager, zero touch reference build process. So in order for us to use copy profile, that meant that every time that we wanted to create a new reference image, we'd have to go in and create that initial environment, the layout of the start screen, setting the accent colors, tile locations, grouping, each and every time. Now, we spin a reference image on a quarterly basis, and it was just not something that we wanted to do. So we went with apps folder layout. Basically involves, well, the way I do it, I create my reference image and then I just boot it, right? Go in locally, create my layout, and then I export the apps folder layout bin file. And then I use that bin file during my production build process. I just inject it with a little xcopy script, and it's set for every user that's going to log in.
Up until about 3 weeks ago, we did not have the ability to set the start color, the start accent, or even the desktop background. So we weren't able to provide that complete layout that we wanted to for each and every user that logged on. And thanks to the guys at CoreTech. What a great community. One of the developers at CoreTech produced a little script that would set just those options and a few more. So we integrated that script into our process, and now we're using apps folder layout and still getting, I call it the secret sauce, the set start color, the accent, and the background. And that's for every user that logs in. Now, incidentally, the way we're accomplishing that, the way they were accomplishing that, is to actually inject those registry keys into the default user hive. So it will be there for each and every user that logs in. So thanks to the guys at CoreTech for that.
Okay. All right, we're going to switch to the demo machine and just talk a little bit about our Windows experience.
So as you can see, we've actually worked with our marketing department. We wanted to make sure that we were using some colors that were consistent with the Dell brand. That little background took 6 weeks of back and forth dialogue to get right.
It's not the tech that's the hard part anymore.
It really is. And so they make these brand artifacts available, but it's really interesting, you know, as a guy in IT, when you have to branch out and work with these different departments, just exactly how difficult life can really be. So we made these available initially before we got the scripts from CoreTech. We made them available just as an option under the personalization options, just as a desktop background. And this is how our users would have normally seen it. And so what we did, we brought up an internal blog and we said, hey, look, if you're going to be in front of a customer and you want to, you know, provide a pretty clean look that's approved by marketing, hey, there's two wallpapers there, go and grab them. Well, now we have, you know, because we can actually script this in there, we can provide that consistent experience and we don't have to go and message, you know, go find this wallpaper. It seems like kind of a waste of time, really. We also carry that wallpaper onto the start background, and this was really an observation by Greg, and I just kind of blew it away until I actually heard it from people that are using the product day in and day out. So, gosh, it's so much easier and so much easier on the eyes, and it really brings the whole experience together when that start background matches what's on the desktop. And if you have it set like that, you don't really feel like you're jumping, you know, into outer space. You know, it seems like one space.
It does ease the transition a bit.
Let's see. We've also carried this over to our lock screen and our login screen. And I'm about to be stuck here in just a second after I just trashed
Greg. I have to type my password in front of everybody and try to type back.
Right. So we've also carried it into this environment and also into you know, the lock and unlock screen. So the environment, start to finish, we try to provide a really consistent look and feel. And we've also carried that into our build process, which we'll see here in just a little bit.
So this is where I pretend nobody's looking over my shoulder.
That's
so
right.
I can type.
Everybody close their eyes.
Perfect. Ready there?
Yep.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about UEFI. It looked like several people were deploying Windows 8 one way or another, so hopefully you have some experience with UEFI now. We just wanted to talk a little bit about it because you can obviously internally deploy Windows 8 without UEFI as a Windows 8 logo certification requirement. When you purchase a system from one of the hardware vendors, Windows 8 has to ship with UEFI enabled. So if you purchase the system at home or whatever, chances are it's already enabled on your Windows 8. So there's the main reason, at least that I know of, for UEFI is to help reduce opportunities for pre-boot malware. There are also some performance enhancements that you get, faster boot time. Also, I'm hoping for the day I get a 2 terabyte hard drive. There's probably one person in the room that has a 2 terabyte hard drive, Johan, but I don't know that anybody else does, but I'm hoping for that day soon. And well, you can see there, kind of fits in as a replacement for BIOS. So secure boot, a lot of people get confused. Secure boot's not a Windows feature or technology. Secure boot is a part of UEFI that Windows 8 uses. It does require UEFI native, so depending on your hardware vendor, you have an option to use what might be called a legacy boot option ROM or something like that. You kind of get in this in-between hybrid world where you kind of still have some legacy, but you can use UEFI. What we found internally, based on the versions of UEFI that are on the hardware and the settings that you have here, it gets really painful. So internally, we said secure boot is on or off, and if it's off, we don't care about UEFI internally. So for like deploying Windows 7, for example, you get some value with UEFI for performance speed, but it's not supported in that secure boot scenario. So we internally decided we're not going to take this middle of the road with legacy options on or off. You have to be completely native UEFI to use secure boot. So just a hot tip, if you're still deploying Windows 7 on Windows 8 compatible hardware, we do recommend to go ahead and enable everything so that in the future when you upgrade that system to a Windows 8 or anything after that, you don't have to make those setting changes. Depending on your hardware vendor, this might require a manual touch to actually enable secure boot. To check with your vendor, you might be able to have some scripting tools and things like that to enable them. But we have had to work a little harder to get systems that are out in the environment enabled for secure boot. It has taken a little more tech touch than what we're used to. Some OSD-specific challenges with secure boot. If you come from a land where you used an x86 boot disk for everything and deployed x64 and x86, that becomes more of a challenge as you go into the UEFI world. Internally, we really are trying to focus on our OS platforms being x64. For Windows 8, x86 is an exception. Some of that lower end devices, a lot of those still use x86. But x64, we're trying to make our standard. But right now, we do have techs maybe carrying around 2 boot disks or something like that. I also did want to mention that for Pixie, you need to check if you're using a third-party Pixie as to whether or not they support UEFI. Windows Deployment Services does, but I know there's a couple third parties out there that don't yet support it. So I just want to show you a couple things about deploying the operating system. Okay, great. So while we're going through a beta with Windows 8, it's a little bit of a challenge with Configuration Manager, right? We have to get a system in a collection so that it can be targeted with Windows 8, and that's a bit of a challenge in a large environment like what we have. So we ended up deploying a task sequence in a hidden fashion and then leveraging some variables to do that. So I'm just going to talk through that a little bit in a basic scenario for that. So once we have an OSD task sequence and we create task sequence media, I'm just going to enter in a local path here. Select my boot image, distribution point, management point. And we're actually going to set a task sequence variable here. And I actually meant to show you before we got to this point. Let me actually go back and look at the deployment for this task sequence. So I have an available deployment right now for this task sequence. You'll notice in my deployment settings that it's configured for only media and Pixie, hidden, which means if you're deploying multiple task sequences to a system and you boot from a bare metal, for example, the task sequence selection box you wouldn't see this one because it's hidden, but this is where you actually get the value out of that hidden task sequence. So you deploy it hidden, and then you basically either use a script or use your task sequence media to tell the task sequence what task sequence to run, or to tell the boot media what task sequence to run. So once I have that task sequence deployed, I can then look at and find my deployment ID, formerly known as an advertisement ID, and then in my boot media, I can actually add that. So we're just going to add a task sequence variable, SMS TS preferred advert ID. And then we just enter in the name here. So this is the quick and easy way to do it. If you want to be more dynamic, you can use a pre-execution hook or something, or a pre-start hook to do this. For this example, we just thought we'd put it into the boot media directly. So once we create this ISO, anybody that uses this ISO would then be able to automatically install the task sequence. Just a side note, in our environment, we also use OSD for server deployments as well as workstations, and we always had a challenge because we didn't want workstations to see server task sequences and servers to see workstations, and there's a challenge when you start targeting unknown systems with ConfigMan. So actually in the server space, we're deploying all of our task sequences hidden, and then we have a pre-start that actually will kind of display a menu to the end user to decide which one to deploy to the servers. That way, we can still leverage one infrastructure but hide all those server task sequences from our customers, because in our environment, any user can actually rebuild their system whenever they want. And just quickly, I want to show you a little bit of our user experience inside of our bootable media. So I'm using our bootable media from our production environment, so I won't actually start a full process, but I just want to show you a couple customizations that we did with the pre-start. You notice Bill also got our nice branding. This is actually in WinPE. This is our task sequence that started. So when I hit next, we actually do a check to see if UEFI is enabled on the system. If it's not, we tell the user, and we basically at this point prevent them from moving on. And since we're on a virtual machine, we don't have a service tag like we would normally expect. So we actually capture some additional information from the user so that we can kind of associate as well as name this system in a way that we can identify it in the future. You notice there's a drop down here where you select locations. Since we're not connected to corporate, we get a pop-up saying that we can't continue. But in the locations box there, you saw quickly, we have different locations where the user can select. So for example, if they select Austin, we automatically set some task sequence variables such as domain, OU, and time zone. So that information is automatically used during the task sequence process. That's just by setting task sequence variables using a script in the pre-execution or pre-start area. We also capture that data at this point for what we call our remote media build process, and we save it locally so that if a system is going to be built remotely, whatever the user entered at this point would then be reused later on to join the domain for a full media build scenario. All right, now let's talk about those remote employees a little more.
Right. So the process that you just saw with our boot image, that process is the same for our remote employees as it is for an employee that would be on-site in an office. That same set of tools provided if in fact the system fails to join a domain during a build process on a Dell site. We'll see an example here in just a moment of how we can get that machine into the domain without having to have someone from IT come and join it. So how many people support remote employees? We are a sad bunch, aren't we? They are arguably the hardest to support. Now, everybody knows that Dell hardware never fails, but occasionally somebody might spill some coffee inside of a keyboard.
It's a long story. Yeah. Just happened last week.
Yeah.
I got a new notebook, though.
That happens quite a lot. Actually, I'd like to see some statistics on just how much coffee goes into notebooks over time. But we see that quite a bit. And so that process for getting that user whole again in the past has been a pretty lengthy process. You've got the accident itself or some type of hardware failure. You've got a service call that has to go out. And we've got to create some remote media or ship a system. Typically, if it's not catastrophic, we're creating some remote media to send out to the user. We're mailing that. Once the user receives it, we may have, in fact, dispatched a technician at this point to replace a hard drive. Then there's another call back to the service desk to go through the image and build process, get them back into the domain. This is typically a 3 to 5 day process. Anybody, does that sound familiar to some of you? So as we were going through the 8.1 early adopters program, we had people in the field. We need these people using this product. We need to be gathering this feedback. A lot of folks on the bleeding edge can't stand the sight of blood, right? These are the folks that are going to call you directly. We say, look, you can have Windows 8.1, but we're not going to support it. We want you to provide your feedback, but you're kind of on your own. Boy, they call. They call a lot. So what we've done is we've tried to provide an experience that's going to be consistent for the user who's on-site, also for the user who's off-site. As we've moved from legacy to EFI, it's caused us to kind of shift the way that we're deploying in the process. That move typically is a hands-on transition, right? If you're using Dell hardware, it's hit F12, right? Go and make a couple of changes to the system configuration, and then boom, you're back up in EFI. And as you saw, we actually check for an EFI configuration before we let you continue on. So we want to automate that as much as possible. And in doing so, we realize that process has got to be consistent across the board. So we are doing standalone media for the most part today. And we have the EFI check in place along with some documented instructions for the migration to EFI. I know Dell is working on some tools, a PowerShell provider that will help flip that little switch and take and automate that entire process. I'm sure other vendors will be doing something similar. But that's what our environment looks like today. Now, we don't own every piece of our environment, so when it comes time for us to get a machine back into the domain, we have to know all of the key players in our area that own the little pieces of the puzzle that make that happen. We've got to know the folks that own the edge network equipment and how we're going to make them happy and bypass them through some type of credential or certificate to get into the domain to run some type of script that's going to join the machine. And that's where we are today. So we've got a process, a scripted process, that's installed on every one of our Windows 8.1 machines. We're actually capturing some variables for a site location, as you saw, through that HTA that happens at the beginning of the operating system deployment process, where we write a little log file and we say, find your nearest location. And that might be, in our case, Austin. And so we want that device to show up in an Austin organizational unit when it joins the domain. Well, if I'm sitting at home and I don't have access to the corporate environment, my build process completes, and then I'm kind of stuck in limbo. I'm stuck in this work group. And so what we do is we create this little executable on the desktop that parses some of these task sequence variables that were captured earlier in the process. So this little executable already knows that it wants to be in an Austin Workstations container, and it has a scripted process for importing a root certificate, which is one of our requirements to get through with a virtual private network. It establishes that access to the tunnel and actually connects to the corporate environment, and then it does a simple domain join. Now, we've been looking at some other opportunities to leverage some tools that would allow people to self-service this process and remove this script altogether using potentially some orchestrator runbooks and DJoin, if you're familiar with DJoin, where we could send a user to a self-service portal. They could enter their user credentials, their machine name, have DJoin spit back a blob, and we can actually do that entire domain join offline. So that's another way we're looking at doing this. But today, the process is the same internally as it is externally. It's consistent. We know who all the key players are. We have communication lines open so that if a certificate is about to expire or credentials change, we're able to make those changes on the fly with our media for our employees.
Yeah, so if we need to, we can, you know, ship a USB to a remote employee or even have them download, you know, from a secure location and basically allow them to do a remote media build self-service. And when it's done, launch this executable that walks them through the process, you know, make sure you're on a Wi-Fi, make sure you can get to the internet, and, you know, and then go to the next step, which at one point we actually run an antivirus definition update because that antivirus definitions on the remote media build is pretty stale. So we get some things to make sure they'll get through our network's access controls as well. So we handle that all in that process.
Refresh and reset. We're talking about push button reset. Push button reset has the potential to take that 5 days that we were talking about just a moment ago and reduce it to about 30 minutes. And this would be in a situation where we have some type of OS corruption, not necessarily a hardware failure.
Or coffee.
Or coffee, yeah. Little Starbucks. And we've been playing with this a little bit. This is actually a feature that I'd really like to see Microsoft pursue at the enterprise level, and that's the ability to create an image of a fully built individual machine, capture that WIM locally, and then provide that push button reset experience that consumer systems have for the enterprise. TechNet has some really, really good articles about how to do this. It involves, you know, getting down in WinPE and changing some drive letters and moving some partitions around, and we're doing it. We're doing it today. We've been told it's a little dirty. I think dirty was the word, yeah, that was used. And the reason it's dirty is because we never sys prep the machine when we're done. But why would we want to? The machine's already been named. It's already sitting in the right organizational unit. Really, the biggest issue we have after restoring a machine is that at some point the computer password in AD is probably changed. So we need to reset the machine account in AD. It's been working pretty well for us. So I'd really like to see a supported method for capturing this. It adds about 20 minutes to the end of the build process. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're a remote employee having this option available, the push button reset option available to you, I think it would be a pretty tremendous time saver. Incidentally, when you're working in this, and if you go out to TechNet and read these articles about creating a push button reset image or a push button reset, you'll see pretty quickly that the process is pretty straightforward. It's pretty easy, but you'll spend a whole lot of time in the Windows recovery environment. So here's a hot tip, as Greg likes to say: shift restart will take you back into the recovery environment. I saw somebody rebooting a machine 3 or 4 times, and then finally it said, hey, do you want to recover? Well, there was nothing wrong with the machine. So
just
there's
how to get there. Yeah.
That's right. So I think there's been some confusion about how to get there. That was a hot tip that was actually handed over to me, and it makes getting into that into WinRE so much easier. So shift restart will bring you back into the recovery environment.
All right, so now we have the OS deployed. Let's talk a little bit about app delivery and handling kind of metro or modern apps in the enterprise. I do want to talk a little bit about deploying versus provisioning modern applications. When you use Configuration Manager or Intune, you're actually deploying that. And if you're familiar with the modern apps, you know, it is a user experience, right? It's like going to the Windows Store. You go to the Windows Store and you select an app and you install it for you in your profile. And that's kind of the way Microsoft sees us leveraging modern apps. But I think we all have scenarios where we want to have applications there when a user logs on for the first time. And this is one of the ways we can accomplish that, by actually provisioning. You can actually provision applications using Configuration Manager or any other software deployment tool just with running some PowerShell command lines or DISM as well. Just another note before I go into demo: when you provision, that is kind of staging the application, so any user that logs on after that will get the app. Now, this does also work if you already had a profile as well. So when you provision, basically, that's going to make the app install for that user on the next login. If you deprovision an application, it doesn't remove it from every user, but it does make it so no new user would get the application. So I just wanted to walk through a couple PowerShell command lines. The first one is actually deploying an application, and this would be a similar method to how Configuration Manager would do it. It's a simple PowerShell add apex package, and you point it to the apex file. Now, I'm not going to go into detail about side loading and things like that. We've probably all done a little bit of reading and dealing with certs and things like that there. So let's just go ahead and we'll run this first one, add apex package. This does take a little bit. I'm going to see if I can take the opportunity to show you an integrated feature with PowerShell. You notice over on the right-hand side, I opened up this command add-on. So I'm dealing with Apex, so I can actually type in Apex and get a nice little view of the command list that I want to run. And you can even select them from here, and it gives you the opportunity. Probably can't do it because it's running something, but you can click Show Details and then actually enter in the criteria that's required for the command list you want to run. It's just another way to help you get more familiar with creating properly formatted commandlets with parameters. So once this installs, we should be able to just use a simple command to actually display all the apps that are installed in my user environment. And again, this is a per user type of installation that we're doing right here. And I just did an out grid view in PowerShell. If I haven't mentioned it, actually I did yesterday, right? PowerShell will put your kids through college, so be sure and spend some time in PowerShell if you haven't yet. But once I'm in a grid view, I can actually look at what applications are installed if I want. It's just an easy way to get out and see additional information. Then it's pretty simple as well to remove Apex packages. I can just run this command to remove them. Taking advantage of the pipeline, so any application that has Dell in the name, I remove. Now, let me quickly show you actually provisioning applications, and I am using the administrative or a user with administrative rights to do this. We're just running add apex provision package. I'm saying online because it is an online image or operating system that I'm affecting. You can point this to a mounted WIM file as well to deploy or provision offline. So you just reference the folder path, and it will automatically provision it. And these other commands are very similar to what I showed you for Apex, where you can display them as well as choose to remove those provisioned packages. All right, so let's talk a little bit about pinning applications to start screen. Intentionally left blank, because if you've experienced Windows 8.1, items don't automatically pin to your start screen anymore. Windows 8, obviously, that was probably one of the biggest feedbacks that we had, right? You install an application, all of a sudden you get six new links on your start screen that you really didn't want there. So now we've gone the other extreme where we don't put anything new on your start screen, which I think is great. We do have scenarios, though, where we do want to pin a certain app to the start screen. For example, if I'm making a modern app available in Configuration Manager, it would be really nice to check a box to say, go ahead and put this on the user's start screen as well. That's not there today, but I have submitted a request on connect.microsoft.com, and I highly encourage anyone else to do the same. If all of you would vote, we would probably make an impact, so keep that in mind. All right, let's talk for a minute just about upgrading from Windows 8 to 8.1. It is pretty simple to do. You can simply run a command, setup/auto upgrade. We've referenced a white paper that Microsoft produced, how they upgraded internally from 8 to 8.1. They actually really focused on the user experience and how they did it. I don't know if you're familiar with the company portal, but this is a new feature with Configuration Manager. It's similar to the other company portals that you would get through Intune, but this one is an on-premise portal that talks directly to Configuration Manager. Basically, it's an app that is installed on your local system. It's a modern app, and it actually talks to the application catalog web service to display applications inside of your company portal. There are caveats around the company portal. For example, you can only deploy applications, not traditional packages, programs, or task sequences. But it is a really good user experience, right? A user on Windows 8 is getting used to the Windows Store, and that's where he goes to get apps. Well, now you can deploy this company portal, which allows you to get to your internal apps, as well as if you're familiar with deep linking and things like that. So you can make this portal your one-stop shop if you can really get to where all of your applications that you want available to users, if you can make them available in this space. That's what Microsoft did with the OS. So we want to talk just a little bit and show you a couple things about that. But keep in mind, if you do run an upgrade, you're probably going to get a Windows.old folder, which basically is going to have your previous installation of Windows. So you want to do some cleanup. You can manually run a disk cleanup wizard. There are some scripts out there on how to automate that process. And I built one in PowerShell, and I'll post it either today or tomorrow for basically how to run a PowerShell script that will set the appropriate registry keys to automate the disk cleanup process. You can reclaim a bit of disk space, especially on those smaller devices. That's pretty important. So just quickly, as far as deploying that upgrade using the company portal. So we're just creating a standard application in Configuration Manager, and it's a script-based installer as opposed to a Metro or anything else. And we're specifying the command lines to run. I don't think I have a picture of the detection method, but you're simply checking a registry key to see what the version of Windows is to decide whether or not this should be available. Another thing that you can do if you want to make this a really nice user experience, you can configure it to only run when the user's logged in so that they can run it through a company portal or something like that and check the box to allow users to interact. By doing this, they'll be able to see the progress of the Windows 8 upgrade to 8.1. Just another hot tip with doing that, though, if a user clicks on the Windows 8.1 upgrade, obviously there's a lot of time to download that content. And since it's user-targeted, it's just in a kind of a strange spot that a lot of config mans don't deal with regularly. So a way you can get that content pre-staged is to deploy that same application to all of your potential systems that could upgrade. But you can see I set a required time of, you know, the year 2020 to basically pre-stage that content locally for the user. Hot tip, I've heard that you should never use anything above, let's say 2030, let's stay in the 2020s. There might be something there that might surprise you. So, and always test in your lab, yes. So from a user experience, this is a quick screenshot of the company portal with only a couple applications available. Again, this is the company portal that is on-premise with Configuration Manager. And you see we just have a couple options. There's a 7-zip as well as the upgrade to Windows 8.1. And the user would select that. Within a couple minutes, they receive the notification that the Windows is upgrading. And it'll run unattended unless there's an error. And then it'll also tell you that it'll restart a few times. And the process is fairly painless. It happens pretty fast. And well, let's go to patching now.
I'm curious, how many people send out all of their Microsoft patches every Patch Tuesday? Ah, some brave ones.
So well, security patches plus all other Windows updates for your platform, basically.
That's right. So that's basically what we've started doing with Windows 8.1. The updates that were coming, the security-related updates, were going to go out the door on Patch Tuesday no matter what. And that's really what our Windows 7 environment looks like today. We will patch anything that's marked critical on day one. Generally, by the Friday of that week, we've got about a 90% patch penetration for that given patch window. For Windows 8.1, we've looked at this a little differently. I should go back for just a moment. With Windows 7, what we've done is we've taken the non-critical updates from the previous month, and we'll roll those into the current month. So we're not actually deploying just a ton of updates each and every month. It's not marked critical. It's not going out same month. Taking a little different approach with Windows 8 and with Windows 8.1, the updates were coming at us so fast that we're fixing problems that our users were identifying on a pretty regular basis that we put them all in there. As part of an early adopters program, you can do that. I call that shooting at will, right? Because you've hung yourself out there as a beta tester, so you're going to get whatever we've got. The experience has been pretty good. About the same time that somebody would identify a problem, we'd have an update that would come in and would resolve it. So in the early stages of deploying an operating system, I'd take a hard look at that. If you've got some systems that aren't going to be impacted by any type of downtime, I would definitely take a look at revising your patch strategy, at least in the short term, until that becomes a production operating system in the production environment, to go ahead and update them with whatever is coming from Microsoft.
All right, just a few resources, some generic ones. If you look in your guide for this week, you'll find there are several other sessions talking about Windows 8.1 and deploying. Definitely take a look, see what there's out there to offer. A couple other things to mention, slides for this session as well as any other session. You'll find those on the TechEd site, as well as the recordings for all sessions. I've found a couple of people weren't aware of those, so be sure and check those out. Resources, your standard ones, mentioned most of them there. Make sure you complete an evaluation, please. It's important for us to know what you like, what you don't. We've got a little bit of time. We'll open it up to the mics, and we'll be available after that as well. But if anybody wants to go to the mics, we can do that first. Perfect. Thank you.